Well, recreational marijuana is in. GMO food labels are out. Oregon keeps a Democratic senator and governor and legislature amid a Republican tide across the country. These are but a few features of election 2014. Now that the attack ads and mailers are gone, or at least in the recycle bin, and the counting is pretty much over, we can look back and make some assessments of what led to the outcomes in the election. And we have a pretty good person to chuck the questions to in the person of Dr. Bill Lunch, professor emeritus of political science at Oregon State University and regular political analyst for Oregon Public Broadcasting. Bill Lunch, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, Jeffrey. How are you?
Good. Pleasure to have you here. I was going to ask you what jumps out at you in this election, but let me go even further back in time and phrase this in terms of what you saw coming as the trends in this election appeared to be developing through the heart of campaign season.
Yeah, well, as we looked at the polling going into the 2014 election, it was pretty clear the Republicans on a national basis were going to do well, and they did. If you look at where the U.S. Senate seats that they took were located, they tended to be in the East, the South, and the Midwest. And those are all geographically areas in which the Republicans have been doing better in recent years than the Democrats have. Another seat that the Republicans recaptured was in Alaska, but Alaska, in political terms, is really close to a mountain state in terms of its behavior, someplace like Wyoming, let's say, for example. So the places where the Republicans did well were places where they have done well. Some of the Democrats, the Democratic senator from Alaska, Mark Begich, is a good example, won their seats in years, or 2008, a year when the Democrats did extremely well. So it was a high tide year for the Democrats. And the Republicans came back 6 years later and retook a lot of those states. So in some sense, what happened wasn't a surprise. But the Republicans clearly had a good night on Tuesday. We will now have a thoroughly Republican national legislature, Congress. They will send lots of things to the president that he will veto.
So it's going to be the same sort of situation, you think, with a lot of no going on, just this time coming from the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue?
Yeah, we've certainly seen this lots of times before. It's hardly new in our politics that we have Congress controlled by one party and the presidency controlled by the other. And under those circumstances, although small things can be done and probably will be, there are probably some small pieces of legislation that can be passed because there's such a profound difference now between the parties. They're much more polarized than they were even in the relatively recent past. There are political scientists who have specialized in doing statistical analyses of the votes in Congress and there's other ways of measuring polarization. And no matter which way you do it, no matter how you slice that apple, you discover that we are in one of the more extraordinarily polarized periods in our history, arguably more polarized than any time going back to the Civil War and the period of intense political conflict that followed the Civil War for about 30 years.
I think one of the analyses you're talking about was one that showed that the farthest right Democrat was still to the left of the farthest left Republican.
That's right. Yeah, that's one piece of a larger puzzle, but that's one way of characterizing it that's correct.
A lot of gaps between them. And is it just me, or do the midterm waves seem much sharper under Obama than under any other recent president?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that. Keep in mind that, for example, in 2006, when George W. Bush was president, there was a very strong Democratic wave that retook control of the Senate for the Democrats, and the Democrats at that point retook control of the House. The House had been under Republican control, but the Democrats seized it in the 2006 elections. If you go back earlier than that, think about when Bill Clinton was president. And in 1994, the Republicans had a field day, picked up 47 seats in the House that year. So what we've had is more sharply defined or strong wave kinds of elections in the last three presidencies. And what that reflects in turn is this polarization, which is in part a D.C. phenomenon. I mean, the folks in D.C. may as well be wearing sweatshirts that have a big R or a big D on them as they walk down the street. But it's also out in the public. Now, I don't mean to say that every American is either strongly Republican or strongly a Democrat. That's not true. Most people are somewhere in the mushy middle. But the kinds of folks who are active in politics, who do things, who, for example, volunteer to help with campaigns or, for that matter, even make a very small, modest contribution of $25 or something very limited, those kinds of folks, the activists and contributors, and I must say, usually these are quite active folks in their communities. They're the kinds of people who do things with the Chamber of Commerce or the Rotary Club or the local food bank. Those kinds of folks are much more polarized now in their views than they used to be.
All right, so all society from top to bottom, it sounds like, certainly sharing in the polarization in Washington. Bill Lunch is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Oregon State University. We'll come back and do some more postmortem on election 2014, and you can join the party, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Back with Bill Lunch and you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We are doing a postmortem on election 2014, looking at the corpse and trying to figure out what exactly went on here. Bill Lunch is our guest on the exchange. He's a professor emeritus of political science at Oregon State University, well-versed in Oregon and national politics. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we figure out what added up to what happened on Tuesday night. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, well, it's the same number, 800-838-3760, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were talking about the midterm elections, and Bill, you mentioned the 1994 Gingrich Revolution, which put the Republicans in control of the House for the first time in 40 years.
Yep.
I'm curious about the strange mirror that John Kitzhaber seems to have, because he first got elected governor for his first term during that 1994 wave. In two very strong Republican waves in 2010 and 2014, he got his third and fourth terms.
Right.
Charmed life or something? What's going on here?
Well, part of it is that Governor Kitzhaber is a very talented politician. He has many strengths, and so you have to give him some positive credit. But there's another component to this, and that is you have to think about who Kitzhaber has had as Republican opponents. We start back in his initial contest in 1994 when he won the governorship. He was running against Denny Smith, who was basically a far-right Republican former member of the House who had lost his House seat because he was basically too conservative for the Mid-Valley district that he had represented for a few terms. Then in 1998, which you didn't mention because it was a more Democratic year, but the governor had the luxury of being able to run against Bill Sizemore, an anti-tax activist, but a very, very far-right and controversial figure. Then we jump over the years when Ted Kulongoski was governor, and Kitzhaber ran, I think, in probably his toughest race against in 2010 against Chris Dudley, the former pro basketball player, who was a moderate Republican and probably had the best chance of beating Kitzhaber of any of his opponents. But by 2010, the Republicans had been damaged in the key locations in the state. If we look at the state as a whole, your neck of the woods, southern Oregon, if you are looking specifically at Ashland and Medford, is pretty competitive. But generally, southern Oregon is a quite conservative area. That's where Dennis Richardson is from, for example. But not very many votes are cast there, viewed statewide. The key votes on a statewide basis come out of the Portland suburbs, Washington and Clackamas counties. And although Chris Dudley was from Clackamas County, he lived in Lake Oswego, he's now moved out of state, he carried Clackamas County narrowly. The Republican name, some people call this the brand, had been damaged enough that he lost Washington County. And that's usually the key. For a Republican to win on a statewide basis, he or she needs to pretty much carry Washington County, and usually by more than a couple of points to be able to prevail, because Multnomah County, which is where Portland is located, is very heavily Democratic now, and to a somewhat lesser degree, as are Lane County, that's where Eugene is, and where I live in Benton County. So if you look at the math on a statewide basis, the balance of power for heavily contested statewide races tends to be in the Portland suburbs, most notably Washington County. Finally, in 2014, the election just concluded, the governor had the luxury of running against Dennis Richardson, who, number one, was not well known on a statewide basis, and number two, had taken a wide range of positions, particularly on social issues having to do with the independence of women, same-sex marriage, that sort of thing. Those positions worked very well for him in his legislative district, which is quite conservative, but they didn't work on a statewide basis.
Bill Lunch, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about election 2014 and doing a postmortem on it. And here is Grumpy John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Bill Lunch.
Thanks very much. I think you're making too much of a big deal about the differences between Republicans and Democrats. I mean, yes, there's the hot button issues. You've got the guns and the women's rights, but those really don't count in the reality of today's world. That's just to rattle cages and get voters out. What's really going down is the KXL, the pipeline, and the FPP, the Pacific Trade Agreement, that is going to really wreck our economy. And by getting those Republican votes combined with Obama's sellout to big business, we are really hosed, and that's what's going down. It's not the Democrats. It's not the Republicans. It's the big money that is going to take our economy to the third world status.
All right. Thanks for that, Grumpy John. Bill, thoughts about that?
Well, the economy is whatever specific focus one may have, and Grumpy John has some very specific references that most people wouldn't necessarily recognize. He's obviously a much better informed person than most voters. But the economy is always, always a key issue. Having said that, if we look at the 2014 results, the economy has improved significantly under Obama. If you look at where things were in terms of unemployment rate or business failure percentages, there's a whole raft of statistics that were in place when he took office in 2000, elected in 2008, took office in 2009. Those are much better now, but he and the Democrats haven't gotten credit for that. Part of that has to do, as I say, with where the key Senate contests were located. They tended to be, not in every case, but most of them were in heavily Republican states.
Like Arkansas, for example.
Yeah, Arkansas is a good example. Alaska is another example. North Carolina, much more contested. That's one of those that isn't necessarily so heavily Republican, though it tends that way. So if we look at the states where the Senate seats turned over, the one way of thinking about the 2014 results was that even though the economy was substantially improved, the Democrats didn't get much credit because the underlying proclivity or preferences of the voters in those states tends to be in favor of the Republicans. I'll just give you one other example that I found quite striking. Turns out that in Kentucky, where Mitch McConnell was reelected, there have been, as a percentage of the population, more people signed up to get health care coverage under the Affordable Care Act than in any other state, at least by one way of measuring these
things. Yeah, Kinect really gets a lot of credit for being a really good system.
Right, and NPR sent reporters to Kentucky in the heat of this campaign during the fall and interviewed a number of voters who have gotten health care coverage under the Affordable Care Act through what's called Kinect in Kentucky, who said, this has been a real godsend for me and my family. I'm very glad that we've got health care coverage, and I'm voting for McConnell. So there have been other things at work in the elections in 2014. In the case of Kentucky, environmental issues and the modest opposition of the Obama administration to increased or continued heavy reliance on coal has been very important because there are so many people there who rely upon coal mining for their livelihood. But the point I'm making in a way is to agree with John that the economy is a key issue, oftentimes the key issue, the leading one, but there are other aspects to our politics, and we saw that the other aspects come into play in a very big way in the Kentucky Senate race with McConnell getting reelected.
Bill Lunch, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a political science professor emeritus at Oregon State University, and we're talking about election 2014. And you can join us as we perform the postmortem further, 800-838-3760 around the region, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. The Kentucky case is probably the most pronounced then about, I mean, for example, you've got Mitch McConnell saying he wants to pull out the Affordable Care Act root and branch, and yet wants to keep Kinect, which of course would not exist if it weren't for the Affordable Care Act. And yet it's not just Kentucky, because there are so many places where I've had a chance to look at some of the exit poll analysis where issue by issue, the electorate tended to agree with the positions that Democrats take, but they voted for Republicans.
That's right. Well, there's a new survey out from the Pew Charitable Trust poll. Listeners who are interested can look this up online. It's Pew Research, written as one word, so P-E-W, then the word research altogether, .org. They have a new survey out as of a couple days ago showing that the voters, by and large, it varies a little bit from topic to topic, tend to trust Republicans more than Democrats on a number of important issues, such as economic management, for example. But when we get to specifics, and the Pew researchers ask people about their views on whether or not the government should help people with health care, as an example, that kind of thing, respondents tended to favor the positions that the Democrats have. So there's a disconnect between the preferences for the parties, at least here in 2014, doesn't mean it'll necessarily be this way the next time we go to the polls in 2016. But for now, the voters have said that they trust the Republicans better on a number of different issue areas. But when we get to specific issues and we ask them about those, they tend to agree with the Democrats more. So go figure.
Right. And we woe be to the person who has to figure out the analysis to go after that and try to change people's minds. Let's go to Don and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange, and Bill Lunch.
Oh, good morning. And we can just be happy in Oregon. All the frustrated Democrats do have the pot bill to, you know, to rely on. But I want to make a couple of points here, if you'll let me. First of all, I think as a scientific experiment, we should clone Peter DeFazio and see if we can run for governor next time. I think that would be great because, especially in the state of Jefferson, I think Peter has represented the interests of working people probably better than any politician I've ever seen. And even though I'm a Tom McCall Republican, but I've always voted for Peter DeFazio, and I'm proud to do so. And then the second point, I'd like to read something from a former president who talks about polarization.
Uh-huh.
I disagree. I think we've been much more polarized in the past. And this president, unlike Governor Kitzhaber, refused to be nominated for another term. This is what he said. One of the expedients of party to acquire influence within particular districts is to misrepresent the opinions and aims of other parties. you can't shield yourself too much against these jealousies and heartburnings which spring from these misrepresentations. They tend to render alien to each other those who ought to be bound together by fraternal affection. And, this is George. This
George
is
Washington.
George Washington speaking.
Mm-hmm.
In his farewell address, I think he was speaking of slavery, you know, and the split over that. And in fact, within his family, there was a split. His wife wanted him to hold on to the slaves.
Right.
He'd inherit it, and George.
All right. So the point being that we have been divided before.
Yeah, and I think the whole system is designed to accommodate that. And I just think I'm hoping and praying that these guys, you know, McConnell and Obama, and a little good Kentucky bourbon, I think they can work it out.
All right. Thanks for the optimism, Don. Appreciate that. Bill, what do you think?
Well, the country has survived very, very serious challenges in the past. The problem with slavery, obviously a huge stain on the United States when the country started. The quote that Don had from Washington was very good. There's also one from Thomas Jefferson, from who held numerous slaves and had a number of children with one of them, as it turned out. But Jefferson, at one point when the Compromise of 1820 was being worked out in Congress, wrote to one of the members of Congress at that time that the challenge of differences or divisions over slavery were like a fire bell in the night, which filled him with alarm about the future of the country. That's a paraphrase. It's not exactly Jefferson, as always, was more articulate, more elegant than I could possibly be. So we've overcut, and now eventually slavery was ended at the cost of 500,000 dead. We had a very, very bloody civil war. But we've been through some horrible periods in the past, and by comparison, the challenges the country has now, while very, very serious, don't, in retrospect, look as bad as they were once. I suspect that Don is right. We will overcome these times, but it is not going to be fun getting there.
No, probably not. And particularly when the elections seem to go whipsaw one way and then the other way, and then 2 years later, a whole different thing again, particularly, as I note, with demographics of the voting public. And I'm looking at the chart that you probably saw several of these on election night, but the percentage of the electorate age under 30 was 12% this time.
Yep.
And the 60 or older, 37%, which is the biggest chunk in quite a long time.
Yes, there's a big difference between younger voters and older voters. This is a development which has emerged in the last few years. It wasn't, if you go back in our political history, there haven't always been differences of political preference between younger and older voters. But that seems to be a part of the political landscape now. And so as we look out towards 2016, one of the differences between this year and 2 years from now is, on a national basis, we haven't seen the final numbers yet, but we'll get something between a third to 40% of those who could vote having cast ballots here in 2014. In 2016, we'll get a substantially larger electorate, probably at least half of the eligible adults, maybe more than that. In some recent presidential elections, we've gone above 50%, which for us in the United States, the French would not be proud of this. But in the United States, to get half of those who could vote doing so is a substantially high level of participation. The point that I'm making is that we will have more young voters and more minority voters, by the way, as participants in voting and in the political system in 2 years than we have had this year. And so one of the reasons for this whipsawing back and forth, as you have put it, I think, quite well, is that it's different electorates. It's different folks making the decisions. So as we look out towards 2016, we're going to get people who did not participate, didn't cast ballots here in 2014, who will be doing so.
Just real quickly, because we're getting close to a break here, is it some sort of celebrity factor? People like to vote when there's a presidential race? I mean, what do you attribute that to?
It's the presidency is our most prominent political office and one in which Americans have a lot almost emotionally invested. And so even though what the president does, quite frankly, doesn't really have much impact on the day-to-day lives of most people, nonetheless, a presidential election draws out the largest electorate, the largest number of voters that we see in any four-year period.
Bill Lunch, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, political scientist, professor emeritus at Oregon State University, back to do more postmortem on election 2014 with your phone calls and emails. We'll rejoin the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Bill Lunch, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Oregon State University, regular political analyst for Oregon Public Broadcasting. We're glad he's agreed to dance with us today as we talk about election 2014 and perform a bit of a post-mortem on it. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions, comments, trends that erupted in your mind, things that made you think, wow, what happened in this election? Join us at 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760. Or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were talking about the differences between presidential and non-presidential years. My own perception is that angry people seem to vote in midterms, at least lately, and the GOP is good at keeping people angry. With Rush Limbaugh, for example, in Fox News?
Yeah. When we go back to the Pew Research numbers that I was mentioning a few moments ago, this is the polling operation that's a nonprofit, very neutral, very fair-minded, that's directed by a guy named Andy Kohut, who's one of the best in the business. They've looked at the question of anger and people who are unhappy but not necessarily angry and the whole range of emotions in the electorate. And what they've found in recent years, and again, for listeners who are interested in delving into the numbers, I encourage you to take a look at Pew Research, written as one word, P-E-W is the first three letters in terms of spelling, .org. There's a wealth of information there. And what they have found is that the voters who say they are angry tend these days to be concentrated on the Republican side. But given that we have a Democratic president, that's not a huge surprise. If you go back to the time when George W. Bush was president, there were lots of angry Democrats. So we were just talking before the break about the centrality of the presidency in both in the political system, but also, perhaps more importantly, for these purposes, in terms of the emotional and intellectual life of the country. The president sets a tone, and people react to it. And in recent years, there have been stronger reactions. Again, we go back to the polarization that we've talked about. In a more polarized political system, it shouldn't be a huge surprise to us that those who are on the outs, who don't, the party that doesn't hold the White House, would say that they are unhappy or angry, perhaps, because the preferences that they have in terms of public policy and public choices aren't being reflected.
Let us take a call. We have Kent in Rogue River on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Bill Lunch.
Good morning. I am interested in what you think about what happened to Measure 92. My suspicion is that there was a different mix of money and grassroots volunteers in Jackson County as opposed to the whole state. Jackson County actually was pretty positive on Measure 92, but the rest of the state less so.
Which is GMO labeling.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what you think about what happened there.
Well, the question of whether or not genetically engineered foods, as they say, should be labeled had been presented to the voters in a different context in Jackson County and elsewhere in Southern Oregon because of measures that were on the ballot for you folks in special elections within the relatively recent past, I think just a, really a few months ago.
Yeah, it was the May primary that had the GMO crop ban passed
right.
in Jackson County.
Mm-hmm. Right, and so voters in Southern Oregon, unlike voters in most of the state, had been introduced to and probably, in fact, heavily influenced on those questions. They'd made up their minds in the context of a local ballot measure, or actually a couple of local ballot measures, whereas outside of Southern Oregon, you have your own communication system. Jefferson Public Radio is part of that. The Medford Mail Tribune, there's a variety of sources. But those sources don't reach up into the Willamette Valley and the Portland metro area, where it depends on how you count, but something like 75 to 80% of the population of Oregon is in the Willamette Valley, if you include the Portland area in that. So there was then a statewide measure on labeling genetically engineered foods. And for most voters in the state, that was the first time they'd heard about it. As you know, I'm sure that Jeffrey and others associated with Jefferson Public Radio have already mentioned that the spending on Measure 92 exceeded anything we have ever had in the past.
Was it $8 million or something?
Well, the proponents of Measure 92 probably spent about $8 million, maybe a little less, but that's the ballpark. But the opponents spent at least $15 million. I was just on the phone with a reporter just before we connected, a reporter from Washington, where a similar measure was defeated on the ballot, again, narrowly as it was here, in 2013. There in Washington state, as here, the opponents spent an extraordinary, unprecedented amount of money. In Oregon, it looks as if the opponents will have spent at least $15 million, maybe more like $16 or $17 million. So if you take the total of all the spending on Measure 92, both for and against it, it's going to be well over $20 million, maybe, in fact, may even get to $25 million. The reason I can't give you a more specific number is that we don't get the final contribution and expenditure reports until a few weeks after the campaign is over. But in the next few weeks, we'll learn more. But it's just been an extraordinary amount of money spent on Measure 92.
Well, and in case anybody's wondering, Measure 92 within Jackson County pulled just about 55%, which mm-hmm. is pretty remarkable for a county that is otherwise fairly conservative and voted conservatively, for example,
that's
in this
right.
election.
Mm-hmm. But that's because people in Jackson County had been exposed to this at the time of the primary and had formed views on it in the context of the local measure that you folks had. Not identical to the statewide measure, but pretty darn close. And so voters in Jackson County had a different perspective and a different base of knowledge on this than voters in, say, Multnomah County or Washington, more to the point, Washington County or Clackamas County, which is where the key votes are usually cast.
Well, let's talk about some of the other major ballot measures in Oregon. I mean, was the passage of marijuana for personal use fairly predictable, especially given that we had Washington and Colorado go before us?
It seemed to be going in. When we looked at the surveys that we had initially, we were getting numbers in not quite, but almost 60% in favor of legalization. Or decriminalization, if you prefer. But then during the campaign, the opponents, even though they didn't have very much money, made arguments that resonated with many people. So that right before the election, there was a survey done by a very careful pollster, a guy named Stuart Elway from Seattle, but he did the polling here in Oregon, he and his organization. And they found essentially the measure, this is Measure 91, the legalization measure, tied. It was just about, and usually if you see support for a measure drop that much, coming down from, say, 59 or 60% down to a tie, normally that glide path or trajectory suggests that the measure will fail. So the proponents of Measure 91 did a good job of getting their supporters out, it appears. We'll know more about that in the next few days as we get more reports on who voted and what the age distribution is very important on this one. We'll learn more about the age distribution of the electorate in Oregon in the next few days.
The top two primary in Measure 90, which went down to defeat, there were some real interesting things that happened here. Number one, I noticed from personal experience, it divided families. There were people in the same household who felt differently about this one.
Right.
Given that, though, I had no reason to believe going in that it was going to end up with a 2-to-1 split, which is basically where it ended up.
Yeah, Measure 90 was a surprise, not that it should fail, because we had had this on the ballot. We had a top two primary proposal on the ballot in Oregon in 2008. And it had been defeated pretty handily in 2008. One of the things that happens, however, when voters in this state are presented with an idea and they reject it, if it comes back to them within memory, now it's one thing if something was on the ballot 20 or 25 years ago, but if it's relatively recent, the reaction of many voters is, hey, didn't we just vote on this? And they're not happy that it's being presented to them again. So listeners who've been around in the state for a while may recall that when the state's Death with Dignity Act was initially approved by voters, it went through some legal challenges and came back to the voters because the state legislature put it back on the ballot about 3-4 years after it had originally appeared. That repeated or repetition of that choice being put before voters did not please people, and the attempt to repeal the Death with Dignity Act was rejected 60-40. I suspect that with Measure 90, the top two primary, there was some of that, hey, haven't we voted on this recently and didn't we reject it? There are some voters who take that procedural point pretty seriously.
I am still surprised, even though I've been at this for a while myself, to look at large numbers of undervotes in races, and particularly where the ballot measures come in.
Mm-hmm.
And let me give you another example here, too, because there was a commissioner's race in Jackson County in which one candidate was listed as the Republican and Democratic candidate and the other one listed as an independent. This is the Colleen Roberts-Kevin Talbert race. The margin between them in 7,000 votes plus the undervote, almost 12,000. That's one example. And then at the statewide level, looking at the ballot measures of the three big ones we just talked about, marijuana, GMO labels, and top two primary,
yeah,
of those three, more than 50,000 fewer people cast votes on the top two primary.
Right.
And is that just because people didn't feel like they knew enough about that?
Well, this happens all the time. That is to say, remember we were talking earlier about well-informed versus less well-informed voters. The folks who are in the middle of the electorate, persuadable, they can go for Democrats sometimes, they can go for Republicans other times, they don't have well-established political views in the sense that they're not strong liberal, strong conservative, they're not strong anything, quite frankly. And for most of them, politics is sort of an unwelcome visitor that knocks on the door every couple of years.
Almost literally.
Right. And shows up on their TV screens, which they don't like either. Anyhow, in that group, there are certain high-profile contests for president, as we've discussed a few minutes ago, but even for governor or U.S. senator that get their attention, and they understand that there's some significance to those offices. But as you move down the ballot to state legislative offices, to local offices such as for mayor or city council, or to ballot measures, particularly ballot measures which present complex or confusing questions, the reaction of these voters that I'm describing, who represent in a typical election certainly 20% of the total of those who will vote, sometimes more than that, sometimes 30%, the reaction of those kinds of voters is to say, I don't understand this, I don't know about it, I'm not voting on it. And so the undervote political scientists call this the roll-off. I don't know why journalists and political scientists use different terms, but they do. And whether it's roll-off or the undervote, we're talking about the same thing, which is to say that for certain offices and on certain ballot measures, you have fewer votes cast than you do at what's called the top of the ticket. When we get to the next presidential election in November of 2016, we will see the same phenomenon. It will depend, the size of what you call the undervote will vary as to the, with regard to ballot measures, as the level of clarity varies. In other words, measures that present a clear choice of policies are easier for people who aren't terribly interested to vote on than questions which present more complex issues. And certainly Measure 90, the top two primary, it's a procedural matter. It has great consequences. I don't mean to minimize its significance, but it's hard for people who aren't paying a lot of attention to fully understand. So a lot of them just don't vote on it.
Bill, we have less than a minute left, but I want to ask finally about the whole demographic shift in America, with us ultimately becoming with whites in a minority in the country. Right. You know, we keep talking about the Latinos will rise up and ultimately put the Republicans in trouble. Certainly didn't happen this election. Are we talking just presidential elections potentially?
No, the movement, the demographic shifts that are going on are ineluctable, and the United States will eventually become a majority-minority country. We're not there yet, and we're certainly not there in terms of the voters. Voters tend to be whiter than the country as a whole is demographically, but that's where we're going.
All right, Bill Lunch, Professor Emeritus of Political Scientist Political Science at Oregon State University. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Good to have you. The Jefferson Exchange is produced by Charlotte Dern of JPR News, also at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Join us again next time, and please have a great day.